to Brettonomics, a podcast series brought to you by the Bretton Woods Committee. I'm Nancy Jacklin, and I'm hosting this series, which is about the international institutions created for cooperation in international monetary and economic affairs. In our first 8 podcasts, we looked at the economic and political rationale for the creation of the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank at that historic Bretton Woods conference in 1944. And then we look quite deeply at the IMF, how it's evolved, as well as the role of the G7 and G20 in that evolution. We also looked at the bodies created for cooperation in the regulation and supervision of international financial institutions and markets, including the Financial Stability Board, and examined the role played by the Bank for International Settlements in central bank cooperation. This part of our podcast series will look at the international institutions for cooperation on economic development, specifically the multilateral development banks, starting with the creation of the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, commonly known as the World Bank. Before we look closely at these institutions, though, I thought it would be helpful to give us some context in terms of the evolution of economic theories of development and the changing political and economic priorities in the financing of development. My guest today for this important conversation to set the stage is Masoud Ahmed, who has the depth and breadth of experience in economic development policymaking to give us this big picture. Masoud is the president of the Center for Global Development, following 35 years of policy experience in senior positions at the IMF, the World Bank, and at the UK Department of International Development. Masoud also has acted as a senior advisor to the G20 on economic development issues. Thank you so much, Masoud, for taking the time for this podcast.
My pleasure to be here, Nancy.
So let's start with the basics. While we could spend an hour debating the meaning of economic development, let's take a simple approach and say that economic development means continuing growth in the gross domestic product, or GDP, basically the economic output of a country, or its output per person. When looking at countries that are not on this trajectory but wish to develop, there have been a lot of economic approaches over time as to how to do that. And certainly not all countries, their resources, their populations, their government structures, and their stages of economic development are the same. So can you give us a general sense, Masoud, of how economic thinking on ways to achieve or support economic development evolved over time the time of the Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 to today, as experience and expertise increased and the global economy also evolved?
Very happy to do that, Nancy. And it is a long period now we're looking back on. So just to give you some broad trends, when people first started looking at countries that were poor and trying to help them to develop, the basic notion was that what they lacked was physical capital. So if you brought them more capital and infrastructure and put in them in the plants and roads and ports that were needed, that would help them to grow their incomes and become more prosperous. As time went on, that certainly helped, but people began to realize, both within countries and those who were working to help them internationally, that it wasn't just the capital. It was a question of how you used it. And they found that some countries were using it effectively and some weren't. And so it was really the policies that governed the use of capital and of the way in which economies operated that made a difference too. So international efforts began to focus on helping them to learn from the experience of other successful countries in terms of their policies. And then from policies, people started looking at, well, what about the institutions that frame those policies? Because that makes a difference too. Mm-hmm. And then say, well, what about corruption and governance? Because for many countries, corruption and poor governance was a big reason why they weren't able to put in place the right policies and get the results that they were hoping to get. So our thinking about development, what makes countries prosperous, began to broaden out. We also, over the years, began to realize that just average incomes per capita GDP was a pretty imperfect measure of economic development. Two countries could have had the same level of income, but in one, poverty was lower, women and children did better, more kids went to school, healthcare was better. So you had to look at how the income in a country was being distributed, who was benefiting from it. And most recently, I would say that there's been one other important dimension, which is that people have around the world come to recognize that what happens within countries needs to be complemented by what's happening at the level of the planet as a whole. We are worrying about climate change and how it's going to make the planet less livable for us and for our children and for their children. Most recently, we've just come through the worst pandemic in many decades. So these are all issues, whether it's infectious diseases, whether it's climate change, whether it's biodiversity, or whether it's how we're going to manage the growth of artificial intelligence. These are all global challenges that also require our attention. So development, as we think about it, has become a much broader and more complex agenda than it used to be.
Yeah, no, I mean, with a global view, it's absolutely clear that countries don't exist in a vacuum. And over time, as we're seeing, the integration and the common global problems are increasing. And you can't just look at development on a country by country basis as if the rest of the world isn't impacting it. I do recall a book written by a group of esteemed economists from Harvard and MIT in 2012, and it was called Why Nations Fail. And they did these terrific case studies going back to the Industrial Revolution in the UK right up to the 21st century to see why some nations succeeded economically and others struggled. And the clear message, is, as you've laid it out, is that success was highly dependent on well-functioning governmental structures as a framework for the economy and an inclusive, equitable society where the population felt rewarded by hard work and innovation. So the increased focus over time on structural reforms, on anti-corruption measures, on sound frameworks for markets and for the economy certainly has a lot of strong analytical support. So now, can you describe, now that we sort of have the sense of how the concept of development evolved, can you describe in this context the reasons and ways in which countries that want to develop economically may need resources from outside the country externally?
Well, there's a different set of reasons why countries need additional resources beyond what they save themselves. Because remember, in most countries, the bulk of investment to grow, to prosper, comes from the saving that the citizens of that country are doing. But you can supplement that, and you can do it, first of all, just to put in those investments at a larger scale and a faster pace. You build the roads, you build the ports that are needed. But you also need financing sometimes to deal with macroeconomic or financial crises that countries might have. And you remember in the 80s, you had the Asian crisis, you had Latin America, you had a set of crises, and a lot of these countries ran into banking crises that needed help. Then there are some countries, maybe at the other end a little bit of the spectrum, where periodically you have the need for humanitarian relief. You may have a natural disaster. You may even have famines. And even today, there are some countries where the risk of famine in the Horn of Africa is high. So you need help from the rest of the world to provide financing for that. And then finally, I think countries need financing also, not so much for the money, but for the know-how and the experience that it brings. And then frequently, when you look at what's the role of international direct investment by private companies in other countries, what they're bringing is the money, but they're also bringing the management expertise, the technological expertise, and the ability to make progress through those complements.
Well, that's sort of a perfect lead into my next question, which is that you've got a whole bunch of potential providers of development assistance or financing, and it's useful to understand kind of this broader ecosystem of who may be involved to see where the multilateral development banks fit in. Could you explain the role of kind of each group and the particular goals and interests that are motivating them?
Well, the way we think about development financing is also changing as our understanding about development changes. So let's start with something that many people are familiar with, which is the money that rich country governments provide directly to help countries that are not as well off, or to give that money to international institutions to disperse on their behalf. And this has traditionally been called Overseas Development Assistance, or ODA, and currently stands at about $200 billion a year. And as I said, this is used both for bilaterally helping other countries and working through the multilateral institutions. But ODA, which is very important because it is grant money, which is to say money that goes out and they don't have to pay it back, it's only part of a bigger picture of financing. We're going to talk about the multilateral development banks in subsequent podcasts, and they're a big part of the contribution that they provide in terms of financing. We just mentioned the private sector, and foreign direct investment is another direct way of supporting developing countries and meeting their financing needs. And then finally, a growing contribution of financing has come through the remittances that are sent back by the diaspora of developing countries who may be living in Europe, in the US, in the Middle East, or in other parts of the world where they have jobs, but they have families and relatives and friends back in their home country, and they send back resources to them. So financing of development is also a mosaic of different sources of financial flows.
Yes. So let's talk about another particular kind of source, and this is the export credit agencies. And this is a kind of bilateral assistance, but it's to expand trade relations between countries. Can you explain the rationale and kind of who the export credit agencies like the U.S. Export Import Bank benefit?
Well, the export credit agencies are one more instrument that many rich countries have set up to help promote the exports from industries and businesses in their own country who want to sell goods abroad. But sometimes they don't have the necessary financial support from the buyers who may need loans to go along with the products that they're buying to be able to pay for them. And so these export credit agencies have the dual role, if you like, of promoting exports from the countries where they're set up. to also providing financing to the countries who want to import these products. And trying to balance the two has sometimes been a little bit tricky to see who's actually benefiting more from this. But they do provide one useful function within the broader range of development financing institutions.
Yeah, it basically is making credit available to the borrowers on terms that are more favorable than they would otherwise get, and so helping promote the exports. So when you look at another big group of providers of financing in this ecosystem, it's the charitable organizations, or what's known as NGOs or non-governmental organizations, that provide assistance. Why and how do they operate in the scheme of things?
Well, non-governmental organizations are often the face of international development cooperation that most people in rich countries are most familiar with. Many people won't really have heard about the official agencies, even the World Bank or the regional bank, but they will know Save the Children or Oxfam or Doctors Without Borders or World Vision or the International Rescue Committee. These are all private organizations that have come together because they believe that they can help to serve a social or sometimes a political goal or a humanitarian contribution that they can make. And they are involved sometimes in their own country. Many of them are very active in their own country, but they're also important players internationally. And some of them are able to operate in places where official agencies have difficulty operating. So they do play a role in conflict and crisis cases. Some of the people who work for these agencies are among the most dedicated individuals in terms of being committed to doing what they can to help improve the lives of people who are less fortunate than themselves. And they add up to a reasonable number. Today, just the international NGOs, the 50 largest that are based in the U.S., between them, they disburse about $23 billion a year in on development causes.
Yeah, well, that's a substantial impact. And so now we're coming up to kind of the subject of this segment of podcasts, which is the multilateral development banks. And they're cooperative financial institutions that are created and owned by governments of a group of countries for the purpose of financing long-term development. Now, we're going to be discussing them in detail, a number of them, in the next two podcasts. But at this stage, Masoud, can you give us a sense of kind of where they fit into the overall scheme and what they can do that other providers really cannot? That is, what are their relative strengths or advantages over some of these other participants?
Nancy, as you said, they are cooperative institutions that have been created by groups of countries coming together. And some of them are global in nature, like the World Bank. It's 190 member countries have come together and are part of that cooperative. Some of them are regional, so in Latin America or in Africa or in Europe or in Asia. Some of them are organized along different lines. So in terms of their membership. But what they have in common are a few things. First of all, they provide financing to some group of their members, the ones who need the money, on terms that are more attractive than those countries can get by themselves, which means to say that they can lend them the money at lower rates than on which they could borrow. And sometimes they provide concessional money, which is not just a loan, but a loan that has been bought down in terms of pricing, or maybe sometimes even a grant. So they provide a range of financial instruments. The second thing that's important for them is that they don't just provide financing. they accompany it with technical assistance, with the experience that they have gathered by working across many member countries, with the policy advice that comes from their understanding of what kinds of policies will deliver the best outcomes in particular countries. So just as our understanding of development has broadened, the multilateral development banks are able to provide the range of things, not just money, but money with other kinds of help. The third thing that's important about them is that because they are more autonomous institutions, more independent with their own boards, they're less motivated by the political or economic policies of any one of their members. So in a bilateral relationship, it's hard to keep the politics out of the development. And to some extent, even the multilateral institutions are impacted by politics, but it's much less so, and that does give them more flexibility in being able to operate in that way. The final role that they play, particularly the global institutions like the World Bank, is that because they are often the largest development partner in a developing country, they also help to provide a framework for cooperation, for priorities, for what's happening in each sector because of the technical work they do. And that is used by the other development agencies, bilateral and others who are operating in that country, to help guide their own investments in a way that is more coordinated. And then most recently, this is the term that people use a lot, is a country platform. And a country platform is a way in which all of these different providers of development support can come together to help an individual developing country achieve its priorities.
I guess the other thing, as you mentioned, with the truly global membership institutions like the World Bank, they're uniquely suited to deal with what you described before as some of the global needs, whether it's climate change or global pandemics, that they really are responsible for helping countries deal with these issues across the world. And so they're very certainly better situated than regional banks or bilateral assistance to try to pull it all together.
Yes, thank you for raising that. And these institutions have over the years been doing some work on global issues, but their main focus used to be on helping individual countries. Right. But most, I'd say, last few years, there's been a growing sense that these institutions, particularly the global ones, but not only, also have a big role to play in helping the world deal with cross-cutting challenges, whether we're looking at pandemics, whether we're looking at climate change. And there is, in fact, right now, a very live conversation of the way in which the work of the multilateral development banks can more directly and explicitly take on a role in addressing global challenges like climate change, but do so in a way that doesn't detract from the work that they've been doing in helping individual countries to make progress. And that is a conversation that has a lot of perspectives that are being brought into the discussion to try and find a way forward that is agreeable to all of those members.
Right. Right. Well, you've made very clear now the important role of the MDBs in the development financing ecosystem. And at the end of 2020, I saw there were 30 multilateral development banks in existence. And we'll be looking at some of the most impactful ones in the series. But there are two quite large ones that we're not covering that I thought I should mention. The European Investment Bank, which principally supports development in Europe, and the Development Bank of Latin America, known by its kind of Latin acronym CAF, C-A-F, which supports development in Latin America and the Caribbean. And I should also note, of course, that in addition to the MDBs in this ecosystem, there are other multinational specialized aid agencies, many of which are associated with the UN, such as the Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and the International Labor Organization, among others. Now, the private sector also plays an important role in development finance, and there are lots of ways that foreign investors contribute to the economic growth and development of countries while pursuing their own business and financial interests. For example, often the contribution is done through what's called direct investment. We know the role of foreign investors in developing extractive industries, such as energy and mining. Their investment in industrial production capacity that might be important to an investment company's own supply chain. Their investment in local franchises for a global brand, such as McDonald's or Starbucks. The role of global construction companies in building dams or transportation systems that generate revenues. But we also know that there are so-called portfolio investments that are important, and private investors have an important role in investing through buying shares in local stock exchanges, and also by lending through loans and buying debt securities. In each case, the investor's adding to the local economy, either directly or indirectly. But in making the investment, the trade-offs of political and commercial risks versus potential financial return are carefully assessed. And this makes the private sector contribution really quite different from that of bilateral, from ODA, or even from what the multilateral organizations are doing. Can you tell us about the role of the private sector as it's being viewed today and in terms of some of the global challenges we face?
Certainly. I would say, first of all, that we need to think about the private sector not just in terms of financing international flows, but also in terms of the private sector within developing countries. Because at the end of the day, economic development really comes about through the energy investments, innovation initiative of firms and businesses in developing countries, supported by the policy framework and by the public investments that governments make. That's the way it's been in history and continues to be. And for that private sector in developing countries, it's important as part of their strategy to have partners in private firms and investors across the world, because they bring the technology, and the examples that you gave are very much in that vein. So international investors go in and provide firms in developing countries in partnership more often than not in putting in place new plants, new products, and broadening out what consumers are able to get. There is also, however, a financial role that international financial markets provide, capital markets. And of course, they finance the development banks, the multilateral development banks we've been talking about, but they also provide financing directly, both to governments and to the private sector in developing countries. And the reason why this financing is so critical is because there is no plausible scenario under which the financing needs for investment, for climate change-related projects in developing countries, and the numbers here we're talking about run into the trillions of dollars, it's $3 or $4 trillion, that these numbers are not going to be met by official financing alone. A large part of this will have to come from the private sector. And one of the important roles of the multilateral development banks that we didn't talk about, and by the way, I would also say it's not just the multilateral development banks, but the regional public development banks and sometimes the national public development banks that together have a bigger portfolio than the multilateral development banks, that one of their important roles is precisely to help catalyze more private financing for development projects in developing countries and for climate and other related projects than even their own financing. I mean, at the end of the day, that is what we need to see. We don't have that now. So far, the leveraging that multilateral development banks have done of private financing has been less than their own financing, but down the road, the expectation is that they'll be able to provide much larger contributions in terms of helping to catalyze private finance.
Yeah. Now I want to sort of back up a little bit, and we've now talked about the multitude of players involved in this in the world of development finance and development assistance, and you've made the point in our discussion so far that it is really up to the countries to define their development plans and their needs with some help and cooperation from some of the expert institutions that we've talked about. But you have an awful lot of players. Has there been any effort over the years to sort of provide a kind of framework for international development financing and assistance? And can you talk in particular, among other things, about the UN and its role as kind of setting some goals and aspirations in the last 20 years or so?
There's been a ongoing effort over many, many years to try and help pull together all of these different players that support development in individual countries, and to be fair, sometimes if you're a finance minister of a developing country, you might find you have 30, 40, or 50 individual agencies who are all trying to operate and do projects and help you, but getting in the way of each other sometimes.
You're right.
Forms and different rules, and so there is a constant and continuing agenda there. I think we have to think about this at two levels. First, as you said, a lot of it is at the country level. That's where the rubber hits the road. And at the country level, it's the country's overall priorities, its own strategy that should drive and help to frame the contributions of individual players. As I said, the use of country platforms is one way of conceptualizing that. That works well, and when governments are strong and have a clear strategy, it's a little less effective in cases where that's not the case. But then there is also a level of trying to provide an overall framing and coordination at the global level. And that's where the UN has played a big role in providing first the development goals, then the SDGs, the sustainable development goals that were agreed in 2015. And the SDGs set out a set of global targets that each country can itself try to meet, running across a range of things from income to hunger to poverty to a range of ways of measuring human welfare. There are periodic stock takes of where we are in terms of reaching these goals, which were set for 2030. The answer to that is not doing so well on right. Most of them. There's also was a summit on climate change, one of the what are called COP meetings, climate summit in Paris, that set a set of goals for where we want to be in terms of climate outcomes, emission outcomes, both at the individual level and globally. So there are those kinds of efforts. And then there's groupings like the G20. G20, as you know, brings together the 20 major economies. They account for about 3/4 of the population and of the world's economic output. And the G20 also serve as a way of providing a guiding hand, if you like, to efforts to improve the degree of coordination and also to help modify the purpose and priorities of individual institutions like the MDB. So there are global big picture coordination efforts of that kind. And then there is the stuff that happens to make sure that within each country, the various actors that are trying to support the country in meeting its goals do so in an effective and efficient way.
Yeah. And earlier you mentioned the importance of kind of country platforms and the role that the World Bank is playing in trying to integrate climate change and development in some of their platforms, the so-called CCDRs. We also have, and we've talked about it in some of our earlier podcasts, the IMF Article 4 reports and IMF-funded programs and signaling programs, all of which provide sort of macroeconomic analysis and frameworks that are helpful to other players in the space understand kind of the environment they're putting their money into and how the country is performing on a broader economic basis.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah. So I want to thank you, Masoud. I think you've really given us a wonderful overview of the development assistance and financing ecosystem and who the players are and why they do what they do. And it's a really good foundation for our next three podcasts covering the work of the World Bank and then of a number of important regional development banks. So we hope the listeners will continue with us in our exploration of the institutions fostering international cooperation and economic development.
Well, thank you very much, Nancy, for giving me the opportunity to participate in this series. And I look forward to listening also to the podcast to come.
Great. Thanks so much. Okay. For more information related to subjects discussed in today's episode, please refer to the episode description. To support Bretonomics, you can share the show with your community. And also, please leave a review wherever you stream your podcasts and give us some valuable feedback. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.